Good afternoon. I'd like to thank Dean Chatterjee and the Questioning Minds Forum for the opportunity to be here this afternoon, for putting on this discussion, arranging it. I'd like to thank David Keller for taking the opposing side in this discussion and enabling it to happen. I'd like to thank all of you for being here and being a part of it and participating in it as well. Well, the subject of our debate this afternoon is the question, does God exist? I have very limited time, 15 minutes, a lot to make a case like this, so I'm going to get right into the gist of it. The God, already heard from Dean, the God that I'm defending is the God of classical theism. And particularly my own perspective is that of Christianity. So I'll be defending the God of Christian classical theism tonight. The omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, all-good creator of all things, the foundation of all reality. The basic theme of my argument can be put both positively and negatively. Put positively, I'm arguing that the existence of the Christian God can be deduced from human experience of an observation of the universe, both the universe internal to ourselves as well as the universe out there around us. But negatively, I'm arguing that the human experience and observation of the universe cannot be explained, cannot make sense apart from the existence of God. This is a strong claim. Not really claiming that the existence of God is likely based on our observation of the internal and external universe, but I'm saying that God must exist given the existence of the things that we know, that God is deduced from these things. I believe, like most Christians throughout history, I believe that there is both an intuitive awareness of God that is natural to all people to some degree or another, on some level or another, but I also believe that intuition is, to be valid, is based upon rational argumentation. It's based upon a real observation of either truths that are self-evident or truths that are deduced from self-evident truths. So I believe that there's rational argumentation that supports the intuition of the existence of God. So what I'm going to do this afternoon is tap into both of those aspects of the discussion. I want to tap into the intuitive aspect as well as make the rational case and lay it out. So to start out, I want to build a case for a couple of major intuitive points. Things that we human beings generally take to be true intuitively, and I want to show that the existence of God is not, without the existence of God, there cannot be these things. First of all, without the existence of God, there can be no purpose or meaning for human life. It only makes sense to talk about our lives having a purpose or meaning, if we have been brought into being to fulfill the goals of a creator. There's no point or purpose for which we have been brought into being if there is no God. Without God, we've been brought into being by nothing but mindless chance, rolling on through the ages. Without God, there is no intention for which we exist. We may have purposes ourselves that we come up with to give to ourselves, goals and desires that we have to fulfill in life. But unless there is a God, our existence has come into being by chance and has no point, has no purpose. And I believe that we are intuitively programmed, you could say, to believe that we do have a purpose in life, that there's a point to our existence beyond just, what do I want to do with my life? What do I come up with my own desires to see? But that there's a real purpose for which we exist, a point to our existence, subjective and universal. But without the existence of God, there can be no such point, because we simply products of chance. Another intuitive point that I want to make is that without the existence of God, there can be no foundation for ethics, no foundation for ethical moral responsibility. To be morally responsible, to be morally obligated, means that there's something that we are supposed to be and supposed to do in this life. But that implies that there is an ideal, objective standard that human life can be measured against, that we have been created in order to fulfill certain ideals. If there is no God, once again, as I already pointed out, we have no purpose or point to our existence, and therefore there is nothing that we are supposed to be or supposed to do, and therefore we have no true moral obligations. Ethics reduces to prudence. We have consequences to our actions, but yet we have nothing that we are supposed to do. You can put this a different way. You can talk about value. We like to talk about human value, or human life having value. And we need something more than just that people like people, we mean that there is objective value in human life that obligates us to respect human beings. But without the existence of God, there can be no objective valuer to give value to human existence, and therefore human life has no objective value. Again, we're reduced merely to prudence. To what degree do I need human beings, in particular human beings, to satisfy my desires? Whether those desires arise from selfishness or from sympathy or sympathetic considerations. Either way, there is no external obligation that says I am supposed to respect human life because human life has a universal objective value. Now, moving on from these two points, I want to now begin to lay out a rational case for the existence of God, going beyond the intuition. In other words, I want to go deeper and say, what is the foundation of these and other like intuitions that I believe that human beings generally have? What are we observing about the universe? I want to lay out these intuitions in a logical, rational format so we can follow them and see exactly what the basis is that leads us to believe in God. I believe we grasp these arguments intuitively, but I believe they can be spelled out in a rational form as well. So let me begin then to make that case at this point. First of all, there must be a single entity existing outside of time and space, who is the ground of the being of the universe. That's the first thing that I want to show. One of the most obvious characteristics of the universe we live in is that it's going through time. It's ever-changing. It's made up of a series of causes and effects. The way things are now is due to the way things were a few minutes ago. The way things were a few minutes ago is due to the way things were a few minutes before that, and so on. We don't have a static existence, but one that's constantly changing. I'm now standing in this podium. A minute ago, I was sitting in the chair. Earlier, I was at home. The fact that I am now standing in this podium requires an explanation, requires a cause. I am here because it is my turn to speak. I'm at this debate in general because I was invited by the Questioning Minds Forum to be here. Why did the Questioning Minds Forum invite me? Probably had something to do with a debate on God and ethics that took place the previous spring. But anyway, there's a series of explanations that logic demands that we ask about my presence here. Likewise, there's no doubt in the world, in many places right now, there are rocks that had once been at the top of the hill and are now at the bottom of the hill. We see a rock that has suddenly come to be at the bottom of the hill when it was at the top. Logic demands that we ask the question, why? Why did that happen? What's the explanation that caused it? Ongoing erosion, the wind blew a particular way at a particular time, the rock was pushed, and so on. Whatever we come up with, there's an explanation for it. This is a widely recognized principle of logic, the principle of sufficient reason, the principle that everything that begins to be and that changes has to have an explanation, a cause for why it began to be or changed. You see a ball that's rolling in a straight line and suddenly shifts direction. Logic demands that we ask why. Why did it suddenly shift direction? Does it make any sense? It's absurd to say, well, there was no cause or explanation for what had occurred. Now, the point of this is that the universe we see around us is full of effects. It's full of contingent things that have come into being. This very moment has come into being, as I said before, from the previous moment, which has come into being from the previous moment, and so on. So where did all this come from? Well, we only have three possibilities. One, we can say that there was a first moment in time and it came into being without a cause. So as we've seen, that violates a fundamental principle of logic. We could say that the series of events in history has been going on forever, that there never was a beginning in time. But there are problems with this as well. If each moment in time gets its existence from the previous moment, somehow we have to trace the origin of all this. What is the origin of the existence that's, so to speak, being handed from one moment to another? To put it off into the infinite past is to ignore the problem rather than solve it. There's also another problem with that, and that is that it's logically impossible that time could have gone on forever in the past. If time has always been going on and there was no beginning, then it would be an actual fact that there was a moment in time that occurred, that really occurred, an infinite amount of time ago. In that case, you can ask the question, how long would it take to get from that moment in time, an infinite amount of time ago, to the present moment? Well, if you think about it for a minute, you realize the answer is, of course, forever. A problem with that. We've arrived at this present moment. We couldn't have arrived here if time had been going on forever in the past. It would have taken forever, literally, to get here. You can't add up to an infinite by adding one finite piece onto another. You can't just start counting 1, 2, 3, 4 and end up in infinity eventually. That's not the way infinity works. So, that leaves us with the third and only other possibility, and that is that there is a first cause, that the first moment in time was caused by something that is itself uncaused outside of time. An unchanging reality that is outside the temporal flow of existence. Now, having established that, we can then ask other questions, like what can we deduce about the nature of this first cause? Well, one thing we can deduce is that this first cause must be only one rather than many. Why? Because although we have much diversity in this universe, yet we have a unity that unites us together, all particulars in the universe. They share a common reality. They share a common laws of logic. For everything in the universe, it is true that 2 plus 2 equals 4, for example. But if there were multiple first causes, then they would not have come from any common source, nor would they have come from each other, and they would therefore have absolutely nothing in common. They would have no common reality. But that's a meaningless statement, to say that two things exist and yet do not share a common reality. To say that two things exist is to say that they share a common reality by definition. So to explain the unity of the universe, we have to come back to a unified, single thing that is the first cause. What else can we deduce about the nature of this cause? Well, we can deduce that this cause must be outside of space. Why? Well, to be an object in space means to have parts, to be able to be divided into multiple parts, therefore multiple things. To be in space means to have breadth and width and depth, and therefore to be divisible. And so we're back to the problem of multiple first causes again. Also, to be in space is to be bounded. It's to have things that are outside of one, that at least empty space outside of one, that outside of this first cause, that is not a part of it. And therefore the first cause could not be the explanation of it. So again, we go back to multiple first causes again. What else can we establish about the nature of this cause? Well, we can establish that this cause must be unbounded in power or omnipotent as well. For the same reason that it cannot be in space. If there is power outside, coming from outside of this first cause, then there is being outside of this first cause that's not explained by it. And so again, we end up with the problem multiple first causes. Now, the second main thing I want to argue is that this first cause is not just a thing. This unified, unchangeable, timeless, unbounded first cause is not a thing, but a person, a personal being. My main argument I want to give there is to argue that mind, or consciousness, cannot be reduced to matter. We tend to think that it can. It's very popular to think that way today, but if you think about it, it can't be reduced. It's true that mind and matter are closely related. Brain and mind are very closely connected and tied together. But there's been no scientific proof that they are the same, and there's good reason to think otherwise. Let me give you an illustration to help you think through that. If you have, let's say you have one cannonball. You start out with one cannonball, and you're not very close to consciousness at this point. Say you have two of them, or three or four or ten. You start arranging them in intricate patterns. How close are you to consciousness? Not at all. But what if we had 2,000, 2 trillion of them, and you put them together in a machine that causes them to be animated and move and bump into each other in complex ways and form complex patterns? How close are you to consciousness? Not at all. Because you're still adding more of the same. The same problem exists with regard to the mind, the brain. The brain, obviously, is not made up of cannonballs, but it is made up of matter, bits of matter. And no matter how complicated it gets, it still is nothing more than bits of matter interacting, crudely put, bumping into each other, moving each other around, forming complex patterns. There's a gap between that and consciousness. It cannot explain consciousness or mind. And therefore, mind is irreducible. Since mind and consciousness is irreducible, it must be traced back to the first cause. In other words, the first cause must possess mind and consciousness, because it cannot come from an own mind. I can go further into it. Is that one more minute? further and say that this mind is going to have the basis of desires, because to be a mind is to either be content or discontent with the universe, the awareness that the mind has. To be discontent is to hate it. To be content is to love it. And we can show that that love and hatred are the basis of all emotions and all emotional life. We can also show particularly that the first cause, one of the emotions the first cause would have would be omnibenevolence, the love of all beings, because the first cause, this God now that we have as personal being, would have the fundamental, utmost foundation for sympathy that is possible. The more you're aware of other minds, the more you're sympathetic and therefore desire the happiness of other beings. The first cause, being omniscient, having all knowledge, would therefore know the minds of all fully, and therefore have the full ground for sympathy, and therefore desire happiness, and not the misery of all beings, in itself considered, although even doing it for a good purpose. I'll leave off there, and we'll continue to pick this up as we proceed.
Great honor to be here, and in addition to being a weighty topic, this is a whole lot of fun for me and my fellow philosophers, I'm sure, and I'm hoping that it's a fun for you and rewarding as well. Rationality mandates atheism. That is to say, it is irrational to believe in the existence of the God of Abraham, that is, a personalistic, anthropomorphic being who transcends nature, is the sole ground and reason for all existence, and who cares about us and loves us. The tools of rationality, namely logic and empirical verifiability, overwhelmingly weigh against theism. The lesson of postmodernism and feminism is that emotion stands beside rationality as a human source of knowledge. The degree to which people believe in God is the degree to which people tap into irrational ways of knowing. At times, it may be reasonable, in terms of practicality, to be irrational. Religionists ought to be upfront and honest that belief in God is an irrational affair. Consider the main arguments for the existence of God in the Western intellectual tradition. Those are arguments that we philosophers refer to generally as the cosmological, semantical, and ontological arguments. These arguments, all of them, are notoriously invalid. Take perhaps the most promising of these constellation of arguments, the cosmological or first cause argument that Mark has just outlined for you. If the universe is eternal, there is no first cause. If there is a first cause, since we have no experience of that cause, then it is impossible and indeed arrogant to claim to know the essence of that first cause. The logic of arguments, such as the first cause argument, either reduces God to a principle of physics and cosmology, which is no more than a hypothetical assumption in a theory about the origin of the universe. the unmoved mover immediately preceding the Big Bang, for example. These arguments, put forth by religionists feigning rationality, turn out to be nothing more than interesting exercises in mental gymnastics for philosophy students, but in my estimation, have no connection to reality whatsoever. The god or gods of these arguments end up having no cognizance or much concern about humans and the human condition, and hence have no relevance for ethics whatsoever. In short, the conclusions of these traditional arguments, such as the first cause argument, for the existence of God, end up suggesting something far different than the desired God of Abraham, namely a hypothetical construction in a cosmological theory. Arguments for the existence of God are examples of conclusions based on emotion in search for logic rather than logic leading to a conclusion. More interesting for our consideration, however, are the positive arguments against the existence of God. A completely coherent worldview can be formed without the need for a supernatural being. In fact, not only is God not needed to form a coherent worldview, which is to say there is absolutely nothing gained in terms of explanatory power by including a supernatural element in your theory of nature, there is nothing to be gained by painting God into the picture of nature. Including a supernatural character in a play about nature makes the plot grossly incoherent. Consider a student of mine that is struggling to come up for an explanation why he missed an exam. He would not be well served by saying he went out to his car to get into it and drive to campus and was suddenly abducted by an alien spacecraft. He would be better off sticking to a tale about a dead battery or a flat tire. When we look at nature, we see that goal-directed activity is an inherent property of all living things. Organisms grow, flourish, reproduce, and die. This goal-oriented activity of biota leads to an equivocation by theists between direction of natural process and directionality of natural process. The fact that organisms exhibit goal-directed activity does not mean that there is only one way, one path, one vector by which that goal can be reached. The path of evolution does not depend on a specific divinely modeled plan, but just simply the capacity to procreate. Human beings are no different than all other life forms. Although it would be better for most of us to have a more well-designed lower back, the weakness of which is a vestige of our ancestors walking on four legs, what matters most for evolution by natural selection is that we can adapt to our environment, pass on our genes to future generations. It is empirically verifiable that there is a continuity amongst all living things. From human beings to fruit flies, we all share the same genetic structure of deoxyribonucleic acid. Given this fact, it is completely nonsensical to pluck Homo sapiens out of the biosphere and place us in an exalted position next to the purported creator of the cosmos, who allegedly created us in his image, but not apes or apples. Ecological science demolishes the notion of a great chain of being which places human beings at the top of natural creation, above chimpanzees and gorillas, but below apes.
Excuse me.
Above chimpanzees and gorillas, below angels. Michael Gabriel. Biology and the fossil record strongly suggest that Homo sapiens is not the apex of evolution stamped in the image of God, but merely one act in an evolutionary play. To make a long story short, I believe that the tools of reason and logic and empirical verifiability and the scientific method that we have at our disposal as rational, self-aware beings are the tools that we need to form a coherent worldview and in no need of a supernatural element or ingredient, and that actually adding that sort of supernatural ingredient or element into the explanation weakens the explanation. So, given this fact, why religion? Given the overwhelming evidence and corresponding logic against the notion of an unseen order behind things, why the pervasivity of religion? Firstly, I believe that we pay a heavy price as members of a species with an awareness of our own mortality and our own finitude. This creates an angst, and it is comforting in face of that angst to believe in a protective father figure who loves us and cares for us, even if no such being actually exists. Secondly, religion and the belief in God, the Abrahamic personalistic God, provides a ready-made structure by which to organize one's life from birth to death, a roadmap that gives one's life direction, meaning, and purpose. But this is nothing more, in my view, than a social mechanism, an irrational theoretical construction not based in the actual constitution of the cosmos itself. The fact that religions are localized geographically is solid evidence that religion is a social construction. Why is it important for us to be here this afternoon? Why is it important for us to not be enjoying the day and hiking in the Wasatch Mountains in the middle of October and enjoying the leaves? Well, It's because the issue of the fundamental constitution of the cosmos and the existence of God is at the foundation of ethics, as Mark appropriately alluded to in his opening remarks. If belief in God remains largely a private affair and does not violate others' fundamental freedoms and rights to pursue life, liberty, and happiness, then religion ought and must be tolerated. However, religions led by God, especially the Abrahamic religions, have an incredibly poor track record in this regard. The conclusion cannot be evaded. Founding ethics and public policy on a likely non-existing being is as unwise as it is undemocratic. Thank you.
I congratulate both of them for giving their time. Now, each person will be asking the other person questions and expecting some response within a scope of 10 minutes. So, I would ask that the questions be short and precise and the responses be likewise. So first, Mark, I would like to ask you to ask David your questions and David respond to them.
All right, first question. Without the existence of God, did human life come into being for a purpose, or?
I tried to touch on this in my opening remarks. I believe that we do have a purpose as outlined by biology, and that is to procreate and pass on our genetic material to evolve Homo sapiens. Above and beyond that, I do not believe that there is any higher purpose or meaning to the existence of human beings or Homo sapiens above and beyond our biological evolutionary role. If human beings never came into being and ceased to exist tomorrow, the biosphere would chug along just as well as it did before without us. In fact, ecologically, we are very unimportant. Human beings are not nearly as important in the function and structure of ecosystems as fungi, termites, and bacteria. And we are an accidental epiphenomenon of evolutionary process. Our consciousness is a tool that allows us to adapt to a wide variety of environments, and we have done that admirably. We're one species that can exist from the Arctic to the tropics, and it is our consciousness and our self-awareness and our creativity that have allowed us to do that. Above and beyond our evolutionary history, there is no higher meaning or purpose to human existence. That does not bother me at all. It just brings to my mind the importance of enjoying every single day as it is, and the gift that we have been given as I put it, the evolutionary play.
All right, second question. Without the existence of God, can there be any moral obligation, supposedness to our existence, to any duty that we are obligated to beyond our own needs and desires? And if so, how?
That is an excellent question, and I really believe that that is at the core of both this debate and the one we had last April. Your main position last April was that without God, we can have no ethic beyond pure egoism, that we do things for ourselves And if we
Okay.
In any case, this is my response. I believe that we can have a robust, altruistic ethic comprised of empathy and love that is far beyond the narrow parameters of egoism, and I believe that it can occur in this way. From my own personal experience, I know that I am a conscious being with hopes, dreams, wants, desires that I want to fulfill in my life before I pass away and become part of the dust. I believe from my own experience that it is wrong to be used by you or anyone else as a means to your end, that I should be valued for my own intrinsic inherent worth, my value of a locus of consciousness, and that I ought not to be used for instrumental purposes, for somebody else's desires or ends. Then I notice that each one of you seem to be like me. You act like me, you have the same sensory apparatus, and I infer that because I have intrinsic value that ought not to be transgressed, you do as well. And so as a rational being, I conclude that like myself, I should value you for your inherent intrinsic worth, not use you as a mere means to an end. Value you for who you are and who you want to be, and that in that way we can develop a robust, non-egoistic, non-selfish ethic based purely on interpersonal relationships, and we do not need the basis of a supernatural being like God to do so.
Third question. In your opening statement, you made a lot of assertions that my arguments for the existence of God were invalid, irrational, and so on. But I don't recall hearing actually any responses to any actual evidence that they were invalid. Could you provide any evidence for your assertions?
The one that I'd like to focus on is the first cause argument. The first cause argument, as you described in the causal chain that led up to us being here in this room, that causal chain what occurred within a spatio-temporal framework that we have experience of. It occurred within the parameters of earthly life and human life and the natural world. I grant that causal chain. The problem that I have with the first cause argument is suddenly jumping outside of the spatio-temporal framework that we have experience of and saying that some unknown, unseen cause, which is outside of the parameters of time and space, mysteriously created this natural order. That is making an invalid inference from something that we know and have concrete experience of to something that we have absolutely no experience of whatsoever. It's a disanalogy. It's an invalid inference.
How would you deal with the idea of how do you deal with the problem of having time having gone forever and not moving over arrive at this present moment if that is the case?
Perhaps my caffeine level is just flagging this late in the afternoon. I was trying, as you were giving that argument, as I have tried to time and time again, both in my philosophy classes and my religion classes, studying Hinduism and Jainism and some of the other great religions of the non-Western world, I cannot see the problem in positing the eternity of the universe. Simply saying that from our limited human perspective, that the universe has existed for eternity and had no first cause. Or if it did, as described by Big Bang cosmology, that whatever we call the impetus, the unexplainable impetus that preceded the explosion of matter from the very small piece that contained all the matter in the universe, whatever we call that initial impetus, God, that's fine, but that's just a logical construction and a cosmological theory, and I don't see how you get a personalistic, caring, Abrahamic God out of an abstract hypothesis of cosmology.
Do you find your disbelief in God, your personal beliefs, do you find any pleasure or comfort in those beliefs? Do you see any advantage in those beliefs for your personal life over against believing in God?
The best question yet. absolutely. I believe that my atheism has been liberating for me as an individual. I think that it has enabled me to value the relationships that I have, my friends and my family, for their intrinsic worth, independently of any grand design that I might be part of. I believe that being freed from the shackles of organized religion allows one to appreciate the beauty of every sunrise and every sunset, the way they are, and to realize that one day you will not be witnessing the beauty that you are now witnessing, and that you should cherish and value that moment for all its worth, because it is an accidental, contingent gift that you have been given to be a conscious being in a very beautiful cosmos.
There is not sure term. By the way, I'm not sure that we don't import your vision that you are taking
begins with my biological orientation. If God is perfect, omnibenevolent, omniscient, omnipotent, so on and so forth, and humans are created in God's image, how do you explain seeming imperfection in the design of Homo sapiens, such as the lower back I mentioned earlier, knees and hips, which could use more cartilage, and the ocular nerve punching through the front of the retina rather than exiting out of the back?
I don't know much about the retina issue, but I was getting excited on it. But certainly there are imperfections in this world. I mean, it's part of the general problem evil is what you're bringing up. You could go a lot further than that. You could talk about earthquakes and tsunamis, and I could add to your list almost endlessly, not mention moral evil, people doing things that are cruel to other people, and so on. In this particular question, I think actually requires a particularly Christian approach. For one thing, Christians believe that this universe has fallen into rebellion against God and under curse. That we expect this world to be full of suffering and misery in connection with that. The story told in Genesis chapter 3 of the fall of the human race and the result of that. Beyond that, though, there's still the issue of if God's the reconciliation of people with God's omnibenevolence, God's goodness. I would argue that there's good reason to believe that God is omnibenevolent, that he desires the happiness of all and not the suffering of beings in general, as I laid out in the opening statement. However, I do not believe that it can be proven that God could not, for a good purpose, for a benevolent purpose ultimately, ordain evil things to exist for that good purpose, not for their own sake, not for the sake of the suffering and evil and enjoyment of those things, but it as part of a larger whole, and that evil and suffering can fit into a larger picture. therefore I don't believe there's a contradiction between God's omnibenevolence and the imperfections and evil of the world.
A major component of your argument for the existence of God was that that what we call consciousness or mentality or the psychological properties are not derivable from matter, and that therefore there must be an explanation or a source of consciousness, mentation, psychological properties, and that we call God. That, however, is based on a mechanistic view of nature that we've been handed down from Descartes and others, that nature is a machine, that nature chugs along according to the mechanistic properties of physics in a deterministic, mathematical, predictable way, and that by definition, because of the determinism of nature, you can't get something like a consciousness or mentality, which is indeterministic, right? The source of free will. Why is it not possible that the mechanistic view of nature is false, and that the fundamental constituents, the fundamental units of nature are comprised of both physicality and mentality, monads, if you will, because on that model you can explain both mentality and physicality from the fundamental constitution of nature without needing to defer to a source outside of nature, such as God.
I'm not sure I fully understand what you just said, but it sounds like you're asserting that just basically that mind is a fundamental part of nature.
That's right.
How is that? I do believe that mind is fundamental to the universe, obviously. I just don't think that it can be reduced to material phenomena. In other words, what we call matter, we look at the brain, we see what we call matter operating there, we see material causes, matter energy, complex patterns of matter being formed, animated complex patterns, because there's neurons firing and things moving around in there. What I'm arguing is that you cannot get to consciousness, to mind, from those sorts of processes, that there's something irreducible about the concept of mind, about what mind is, what consciousness is. There's something irreducible there, and that therefore you're not going to be able to reduce it to something else. It's going to go all the way back to the first cause, and therefore the first cause will possess consciousness. I do believe there's a close connection between matter and mind, but I do not believe that the one can be reduced to the other, as a lot of modern neuroscientists view the situation.
Well, a follow-up question then. Asserting that the mind is not reducible to matter, as you have, especially in your cannonball illustration, it's the way that I interpret it is akin to saying that there is an independence of mind and matter. They might coexist, and there might be relationships between them, but there is some fundamental difference, independence between the two. But why should we reject the evidence of modern neurophysiology to suggest that there is an intimate connection between psychological state and physical state? When people are depressed, we give them antidepressants. When they have a brain injury, they experience dementia. As some of us age, our personality seems to change. If mentality was independent fundamentally from physical processes, it seems to me that the physical structure, the physical character of the brain could change, and that our psychological properties wouldn't. But the opposite is the case. So it seems to me properties are fundamentally unified and not independent. Why should I not be convinced of that?
Yeah. Well, I think we're using independent in two different ways here. Be careful. I don't assert that they are that mind is independent in the sense of necessarily that there's empirical evidence that's separable from. Well, I do believe that it's separable in some sense, but I do in this world. I don't believe that the mind is independent of matter in the sense of being unaffected by it or entirely separate from it. Independent in the sense of being a different thing, simply being something different than what matter is. I think what modern neuroscience and what people have known before modern neuroscience as well is that obviously there is an intrinsic interrelationship that in this life is basically unbreakable between mind and matter. Yes, so drugs affect our consciousness. We fall asleep. That has, you can register a full emotion. You can see different brain patterns, different things, neurons firing, different thoughts, and so on. Definitely, I think that's true. But all it proves is that there is an interrelationship between them. They're tied together. They work together. They have a symbiotic relationship almost in this way. But yet, it doesn't prove that they are the same thing or that mind is reducible to matter. And I think there are good reasons, like the cannonball illustration was meant to illustrate, for thinking that they are not the same thing. So that's where I go with that.
Okay, I get asked a personal question since you asked me one. What is wrong with living life without the idea that there is an overarching, transcendent purpose to your existence above and beyond being a character in an evolutionary play?
I would say there is absolutely nothing wrong with believing what you believe if it were true. There's nothing wrong with believing with whatever worldview is true is what we should believe. The argument is that theism is true. I asked you that question, by the way, so I wanted to show the comfort you find in the world, using you had mentioned comfort in believing deism.
We're all after truth, aren't we?
Okay, so what do we plan to do now? I will be asking each of them questions for 10 minutes and expecting some type of some responses as well. One thing I must let you know is that the two presentations have been extremely impressive, and I have a lot of respect for both sides, but surely questions can be asked, and I think we should ask tough questions. That doesn't mean that we disrespect, you know, their positions. So in that spirit, I'd like to ask Mark first a few questions and then David. Same. Mark. David's point was that when he talked about the mechanistic worldview or mechanistic universe, his point was basically that, as I think, that perhaps there is a dualistic, dichotomous worldview that we have in mind of matter and consciousness, and there are some totally reducible entities. If that be the case, that is a rather older model. In fact, if not a dated model, in quantum physics we know that it's more of a holistic view we get. Now, without getting into the technicalities of quantum physics, let me just ask the first question, which is that if consciousness cannot come out of matter, and if for the matter we need a conscious being to start that process of consciousness, and then we get into this idea of first cause, then the question is, by the same token of this dualistic mechanistic universe, matter cannot come out of consciousness either. So how is it, or could you believe in hell, how the hell is it that a conscious being, if we call that God, gets into this creation process? with that first cause in terms of consciousness, meaning that God has a miraculous power. God can be done, only God can be able to tell us. Seems like it's a lot of presumption. And therefore, there is a beginning of questionable non-circularity, assuming that God will expect you to get the answer from the presumption. That's my first question.
That is a very, very good question. I think that's very profound. I'm just amazed by it because it's very, gets really to the heart of an interesting issue that actually makes it difficult to me because I have an answer to it, but it's hard to explain a little bit. I do agree with you that I can add to your argument that I talked about there being unified one first cause that has to explain all things. There's unity in the universe. So, yes, I think that to have a fundamental dualism, in other words, to say that mind and matter are utterly distinct things, if that were true, if it was an utter dualism, then we'd have a serious problem that would be incompatible with my worldview. I actually hold a position that would argue that matter is actually more of a property of mind, rather than mind being a property of matter. Well, I'm going to bring this up because it's hard to explain. But but your question definitely gets at it. The philosopher George Berkeley argued that matter, physical properties, ultimately all we know about physical properties are the perceptions of them on our senses. In other words, their effects on our senses. A lot of people philosophically will talk about there being some kind of substance out there that then creates an effect on our senses. So you have two fundamentally different things. And that brings up the question you raised, which is how do you, if you can't get matter from consciousness, how are you going to get, if you can't get consciousness from matter, how are you going to get matter from consciousness? How is a God who is consciousness and presumably material also going to bring about the existence of matter? I would argue that matter, it's hard to trace out this to a full argument here, but my position is similar to that of George Berkeley, that the nature of matter is ultimately a mode of mind, and ultimately God's mind, in the end, as opposed to being an absolutely dualistic, separate substance. So I would argue that mind is the foundation, and the matter is the mode of that ultimately, as opposed to matter, as we normally conceive it, being a foundation and mind coming from that. I know I have a lot to say. You can ask questions about it, but that would be my basic answer.
I would like to see more arguments in that regard. Mark, the direction you're going that I find perhaps to be self-defeating for you. You are going more in the idealistic, holistic position rather than a Christian position. I can get into that at this point. Again, a lot of time, but Berkeley, of course, is a very questionable person. So I don't believe that we should simply bring in one authority or person or philosopher from the tradition and say that that's it. You know, he said he can say it to all. Anyway, the second related question is that your idea of telos, a purpose, theology, that comes only when the first cause is established. That's your point, I believe. Because without that, we don't need to have this idea of telos. Okay, if that be the case, then David's question, was that if you can, from that telos, first cause get an omnibenevolent God, then why this superabundance of bad things, evil in this world? Why couldn't it be not less, if anything, at all, if that God, the creator, could be anything at all, and if that God was caring, then of course there would be a lack of evil in this world, and perhaps a lot less evil. Now, one response truly would be, as you get it, which is that the idea of a world that contains evil is consistent with the idea of omnibenevolence, because the world is not a perfect world, it's the best possible world, perhaps, which makes the opposition consistent with the idea of omnibenevolence. Now, I find that idea problematic, not just to me, but I can speak for myself. And the reason is this. Of course, we say that God gave study the Hebrew and the other one. It's one of the many ways to try to make that distinction clear between a perfect world where there is no evil, but still, perhaps it's not all that desirable, it's the best possible world that we should go for, and the best possible world is consistent with having some evil in it. But the problem is this. This idea of the best possible world is not falsifiable. Since then, it doesn't matter however bad the world is, it will hold on to almost a dogmatic idea. Wow, if God was not a inverse, you know? Now when it gets to that point, then we are departing from reason and rationality, getting to dogma and faith. Again, it's a question of making the issue that I raised earlier, kind of following that path. Now people are getting this result, circularity, raising questions, which is to zoom in something and then based on the presumption trying to defend yourself, I mean the presumption in your confusion, you know? So that's the problem, that the idea of the best possible world is not falsifiable, but snaps off faith and dogma, and if you try to show that that's based on reason, then there is this circularity.
Yeah, I cannot prove empirically or philosophically, just reasoning, that this is the best possible world, obviously not. I'm too limited in my understanding, as we all are, as human beings, to be able to do that. My point in asserting that and talking about that subject, though, is because the problem of evil basically is arguing that the existence and the prevalence of evil in the world is inconsistent, is contradictory to the existence of an omnipotent being. In other words, if there's something about there being too much evil or the wrong kind of it or something of that sort that says that, well, now you've got this much evil in it, or whatever, you cannot. It can't be reconciled. It shows a contradiction. That there's no way a good God could ordain these things for a good purpose. My point is to say, I would agree, but in a sense, what you hold on that in itself is not able, you can't reason from one or the other just by looking around you. But that's my point. There's no argument, there's no proof that there's a contradiction between the existence of evil, the amount of evil, the kind of evil in the world, and the existence of an omnipotent God who ordains all things for a good purpose. So there is no contradiction that has been shown between those two. So therefore, it is perfectly consistent of me to believe in the universe as it is, with the evil that exists, and believe in an omnipotent being. And that's therefore reasonable if there's other good reasons for believing in an omnipotent being, which I believe there is, which I
think I have another question to flag that it's not contradictory. You know? Of course it's not. But at what price do you gain this consistency at the price of circularity? That's my point. So you get these two parts of the dilemma. It is contradictory, and people get out of it by holding that distinction between the perfect world and the best possible world, and we're caught into the circularity. So it's your choice. Either way, you progress. That is the point of my point. So I agree with you, yes, no consistency. Not consistency, but at what price. Okay, very quickly, what might I must raise in that area of telos, not the first cause, which is the idea of purpose and morality. The question is this, is it that without your God, the cushion, when I was a mission and important God, morality cannot be made sense of? Then, because we are starting with this world as you have done, looking around based on intuitive ideas and then from there try to bring in reason. Around, we find that both in the East and in the West, in the Eastern world and in the Western world, morality primed all along without God. In fact, without God, in fact, in spite of God. Let me give you some examples. In the Eastern world, two most important sources of morality happen to be, three, four maybe, I can list a lot more, Theravada Buddhism, where there is no mention of God, or Confucianism, which is purely humanistic, or Yoga, where God is brought in as a therapeutic, playful device, not really an actuality. And those give the Eastern world, and Taoism, of course, not example, the Buddha, you know, not a Christian God and personal principle, but not an form of being, great traditions and directions of the morality. In the Western world as well, we find the ancient world. Start with the Greeks, no mention of Christianity, of course that all happened before Jesus, and they did not base their morality on God. What they gave us is moral psychology, which we could call a virtue. doctrine that I know of. No mention of religion, no mention of Christianity, whatever. So, when you have been so adequately served, when it comes to morality, without any mention of God, and when God is brought in the Abrahamic tradition, where morality and God led us to countless millions of deaths in the name of God, I find it a bit counterintuitive, because it didn't mean intuition as the starting point. Why are you making the point that you can't have morality without God, unless you can give us very convincing reasons that I haven't seen yet? Forgive me for a tough question like this and going on, but as I said, to respect the positions, you have to also respect that with tough questions.
So two questions there. First one basically is, if you need God for morality, then why are there good people in the world who don't believe in God? Why is morality taught in traditions that don't have a belief in a Christian or a Judeo-Christian concept of God? There's a few different points to make here. One, I do believe that all people have an intuition of that ethics exists, that there is such a thing as moral responsibility. People sense that this is true. People don't always deal with these intuitions rationally and consistently. However, any worldview is going to have to deal with reality. And therefore, even a worldview that doesn't have a foundation for something might still affirm its existence. You know, for example, I don't think atheism has a foundation to believe in the existence of anything, because there's no explanation. But yet, obviously, atheists do believe in people and chairs and trees and so on, but they have no foundation for doing so. Similarly, many philosophies will teach that there is an objective ethical obligation, and yet they don't have a foundation for it. They hold it because they know that it's got to be true, but they don't have any explanation for it in their system. Another point to make here is that there is a difference between there is some aspect of ethics that can be maintained apart from God, such as there are consequences. Assuming you grant the existence of things in general, the universe, without God, which I don't, but for the sake of argument. If you live in this world, you have to deal with the laws of physics, you have to deal with the laws of social interaction, and you can't be happy living any way that you want. So there's obviously going to be a basis, like many philosophers have pointed out, for restraining yourself, for not killing people. It doesn't make you very popular, get you advanced in life, people around murdering everybody you see, right? So that's pretty obvious. So there's going to be motivations coming purely from selfish considerations or other human desires like sympathy that will lead to some ethical behavior. Sometimes ethics means basically prudence in behavior. Some of the ancient Greeks even used it that way, as well as modern people. And in that sense, I grant that to some extent you can account for prudence apart from God, again, granting the existence of anything. What you cannot ground apart from God, though, is the existence of moral obligation, in the sense that there is something that I am supposed to do. I have a duty. Not just I have desires and how do I best fulfill them, but I actually have a duty to do something. There's something I'm supposed to be. There's something I'm supposed to do. Some moral obligation outside of my desires that gives me an ideal that I'm supposed to live up to. That I do not believe you can have apart from God, because there is no objective value in the universe. So sometimes the terminology is confusing. Ethics sometimes refers to just basically prudence, and in that sense, to some degree, but not sufficiently, I think, it can exist in other worldviews. And sometimes it refers to moral responsibility, in which case I don't believe it can exist at all. Also, even people in the world in other religions, some of them might be ethical partly because they believe in the existence of ethics, so they have no foundation for it. Other people might behave well because of considerations of prudence, which I would ultimately consider non-ethical motivation for behaving well in the end, but certainly something that's available to anybody who lives on Earth and has to deal with law and physics and laws of social interaction and so on.
Thank you, Mark. Before I turn to David to ask some good questions, just one comment. I still can't understand that in good philosophy, good morality, which is the basis of Western morality, in fact, Christianity has always been here as something. The Christian religions have taken up the lead given to us by Plato. Also, in that sense, they have not made much progress brought the idea of God and because Plato's form of good by God. But the idea of obligation. part of the creation. He's the central notion in philosophy, which is still the idea that confuses morality today. The Western world now close. I'm not from here that in Buddhism, Christianism, makes no sense of moral creation. But anyway, I'd like to turn to David now and ask you some tough questions. Mark gave the most wonderful analysis of the first cause and the last line. We have to believe in the prime mover, and that we has to be consciousness. And from that, he, in an almost a priori fashion, deduced why that conscious being has to be all powerful, all good, and all knowing. Now, you don't get too much into that. To refute that point, you went rather straight into why, based on modern science and certain other aspects of biology or evolutionary biology, we don't need to believe in God. Now, just because we don't need to believe in God, in the sense that we can explain our universe in a more concise fashion, without believing in God hypothesis, that in itself does not show that God does not exist. So I was hoping, can we go a bit beyond that to show that even though we don't need God, perhaps maybe God is still there, perhaps God is still there. And explanatory need is not the only thing in the world, okay? Our only way to show that something cannot be there beyond it. So can you give us something that either in the realistic or a prior way, for example, David proceeded to show in what way the demanding claim that David is making, that the Abrahamic God is indeed the first cause. It's very demanding because that God has to be exactly the way it has been laid out in Christianity, in the tradition. All powerful, all knowing, all good, is both personal as well as transcendental, is both real and supernatural. Along with that, God comes to hell, heaven, those ideas and angels, the whole area of belief, you know. And the more man you claim is, the harder you defend it. In response to that, how David went, you did not go far enough, and if you don't, how do you still mention the fact that we don't rationally need to believe in God? How can you maintain your atheism based on what you did?
This is what we love about Dean Chatterjee, always pushing our limits and forcing us to go a step beyond the conclusion that we felt comfortable arriving at. I'm an empiricist. I believe that the starting point of knowledge is concrete, tangible experience. So is Mark. That is why we make good interlocutors in this kind of discussion, because we both like to start with what is observable in our everyday lives. From that point, we go in different directions. There is no evidence that I have ever seen in my life that a anthropomorphic caring being cares about me or intervenes or has anything whatsoever to do with my life or the lives of those of the people around me who I love and care about. Like the best of all possible worlds hypothesis, there is no way to prove that a supernatural being does not exist. To do that, I feel I would need to be omnipotent and omniscient myself. And I am a human being rooted in spatiotemporal earthly existence, so what I can do to the best of my ability is assess the evidence at my disposal. I see no evidence whatsoever for a personalistic Abrahamic God. The God of deism, the God of Ben Franklin and some of the founding fathers, the founders of this country, is a possibility. That God, as you know, created the world as a watchmaker creates a watch and disappears and wanders off to some other part of the cosmos and is completely disattached, completely unconcerned, devoid of any care or love for us and our lives and what our destiny is, whether we're saved or damned or whatever. My atheism is based on the preponderance of evidence that I have at my disposal, which I observe from the life sciences, from biology, from ecology, the fact that Homo sapiens, the form of us, does not seem to be any pinnacle of evolution, and that we will likely go extinct and be superseded by another being, perhaps a more superior being, perhaps Nietzsche's Übermensch, that we do not mark an end point of evolution, that there is no fossil evidence for that, that suddenly evolution will come to an end. And as I pointed out before, according to the science of ecology, human beings are very unimportant in the function of ecosystems. So if we have such an exalted, privileged role in the great chain of being and in the created universe, and we are created in the image of God, the evidence overwhelmingly weighs against it and suggests atheism in terms of the Abrahamic traditions.
But just to rephrase, a kind of phrase, the Chinese famous line, just because you haven't hung on the WND no evidence yet about the evidence doesn't mean that, that the evidence that, sorry, it's a famous line. No evidence of.
It's all on.
It hasn't not been found yet, that doesn't mean that there's no evidence of that kind of mind.
Evidence is not evidence of absence.
The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. Teaching is evidence. Then, yes, perhaps you have not found evidence yet. Would that mean evidence of absence? And so what that perhaps means to go a step beyond. Who knows if tomorrow we find something? Who knows? Anyway, I would like to pursue a different direction of it. But before we open it up for discussion, we have two mics on two sides, one over there, and there's a mobile microphone on this side. And we'll be asking you to ask a couple questions, too, please. One more question. Now, the role of faith, David, in your worldview, Mark is taking a purely rationalistic position, and then the problem is Mark will be either he has to say that there is no role of faith in Christianity when it comes to God, because reason has done the job, and that would be a big problem in Christianity, because faith is such an important there. Or he has to say reason cannot go all the way, and then he cannot get what he wants, namely a rational basis for God, much has been left on the phenomenon or something. But with you, if I can ask, in your godless world, where faith coming, in what form, and faith in what, do you see any role of faith in your worldview? And if there is any, what's the role? Is that if there isn't any, why not?
I believe that the rationality, as we have been talking about all afternoon, it has been the organizational principle of the Western intellectual tradition of which I have been immersed in and studied in. But I believe that one lesson of the 20th century has been that reason and rationality are not the only sources of human knowledge. We are not Spock-like beings walking around making logical judgments a priori in mathematical, logical, formalistic terms all the time, because we are also passionate, emotional beings. And faith, in my view, is a non-rational, irrational way of knowing, and it should not be drawn into the framework of the kind of discussion we're having this afternoon about logical, rational, justifications for the existence of God. That's what, so I believe that faith has a role in human lives, as does intuition and emotion, and that is one of the lessons of feminism. But I do not believe that faith, being subjective as it is, should enter public policy discourse and be the foundation of decisions that we make as a people, as a pluralistic people, in the town square, in the public square, that those elements should be kept at home, and that when we come together in public, we should base our decisions on other things than faith and emotion and intuition, because as subjective, they do not provide a good foundation for sound governmental public policy. And I threw that in my talk for a reason. Over the last 5 years, I believe that there is a growing concern that I have that public policy decisions in this great secular political framework that we have been given is being compromised by the inclusion of faith and other non-rational considerations in public discourse.
Seems like you and Mark are coming rather close together, because Mark has this deep and abiding respect for reason as well, and that's what prompted him to take the position that he did or that he does. So in that sense, it seems like you are a secular humanist person based on reason, and you are taking the position of reason based on reason. And I think that's a very good pinpoint that reason perhaps can bring us together, and from there we can talk about public policy based on reason rather than perhaps on faith. And I don't think much we go very far from that. Given that,
would you like to comment? I wonder if I can make one comment.
Sure.
Faith, preachers.
Just to clarify my own position, as you're defining faith, I think your definition of faith is what causes the conflict between faith and reason. I do believe in faith, but I don't define faith as believing something without any good reason. Faith is believing something. You can have bad faith by believing something you have no reason to believe in, or you can have good faith by believing something you do have a good reason to believe in. So I don't think faith is in the way Christians use the term faith is not the way you're using it. It's not something antithetical to reason or as a different source of information from reason. It's simply believing something. And Christians, as well as secular humanists, ideally believe in believing things on the basis of good reason as opposed to no reason or bad reason. But okay, so we can agree there. It's just that I would not say that that's what Christians mean by faith the way you're using it.
Excellent. Invite you to come over to ask a question. I'm sure all of you have your questions. Make them very pointed, emphasized, and very short. And let us know which person would like to do a big question. We have two microphones on the sides. Oh, please go over there.
Okay. I think the question is flawed in itself because you cannot prove God does not exist any more than you can't prove the Easter Bunny does not exist. I mean, with science, you can't prove anything does not exist. That's impossible. However, does that mean that there's a 50-50 chance? Does it mean that there's a 70-30 chance? I believe in Richard Dawkins' book, The God's Illusion, in chapter 4, he goes very well into why it is very improbable that the first cause was caused by God, because of the idea of complexity. In our world, in biology, in all the science, we see complex things coming from simple things. We see simple things turning into complex things. We do not see some complex being coming out of nowhere and doing a very simple thing like the Big Bang. Although we don't know what caused the Big Bang, we do know that it must have been something simple. It could not be something complex. And that is why God probably does not exist when it comes to first cause. And just to answer the issue of time, when did time start? Has the universe existed forever? I believe Stephen Hawking says that time started as we know it at the Big Bang. So anything before that is not relevant to time as we know.
So you have a question for the
So my question is, what evidence do you have that a God caused the first cause and not something else outside of morality and purpose? Because just because we need God to be moral does not mean he exists.
Well,
that's
kind of a point of my statement. In a sense, there is a similarity between the singularity that is timeless that some modern scientists accept and the first cause. But the first cause, I went on to argue certain aspects of the nature of that first cause, including arguments for why the first cause must possess consciousness and the basis of love and hate and things of that sort. So that makes it God as opposed to some non-personal thing. That
over there? Yes, question regarding, initially in your argument, you say that the first cause cannot be of this world, it's beyond time and beyond matter, but at the same time, the Abrahamic God created man in his image, and Christ himself was of matter. That seems to disprove that whole sect. But somehow we could exist out of and come into and go out of matter.
Well, the reason why the first cause has to be us, it has to be timeless, as I explained, is because it's the first cause. Anything in time, when time is going by, you have changes. You have a new moment that has to be explained by the previous moment, and so on. So you need something to begin that process, was my point. That thing obviously will be timeless, because it will be, that otherwise wouldn't be the first cause, which is the other step in the chain. So that's why it has to be outside of time and space, the boundaries of particular objects in space. Now, the other part of your question deals with really the incarnation of Christ. I do believe that God was incarnate in Christ, took on human nature in Christ. I don't know why that would be inconsistent with God being in his own divine nature outside of time and space. He took on a human nature, expressed himself through a human nature in a unique way in Christ without ceasing to be anything that he is intrinsically, such as having a divine nature which is outside of time and space.
So can I follow up on that real quickly? Just, if that's the case, then when he was the first God prior to starting time and space, was he a physical being, meaning that he had a body in the image of a man? Because I don't know how that could be. Because that's the Abrahamic God.
I don't think that is the Abrahamic God, but there would be a classical Christian versus LDS dispute. I don't see God in a physical form in the sense that we do, because a physical object is a limited object. It is in one place, and you really can't separate even what we call a physical world from time. And so a physical object is a bounded object and cannot be the explanation for all the reality. So it would be beyond the physical world that we know.
Okay, I'm Joel Layton. I made this since about 3 hours after conception. And I've been married for about 37 years to a wife who is also atheist. She has multiple sclerosis. And one of the things that I've most admired about her is she's never faced herself to the point where she got into that self-defeating, blinding attitude. I've accused myself of not having any meaning to my life because I'm an atheist. And my question here, maybe more there is a God ultimately.
I wouldn't say just believe in God because you need a purpose. Actually, I would argue rather that you should believe that you have a purpose because there's no reason to believe in the existence of God. So it's not a truth and falsehood. Whether you like it or willing or not is not the issue. The question is, what is reality like?
I absolutely believe in free will, and I reject the deterministic nature as a machine model that would be consistent with Freud and mechanistic psychologists as well as Newton and Descartes and others. I believe that we have free will because the constitution of our bodies has a significant number of monads, or the fundamental units of nature, that have a high degree of mentality, much more than this watch, that has a high degree of physicality. So I believe that unlike Mark, that the fundamental constituents of nature are the same things that have both mental and physical properties, and it is the mental properties in those fundamental things that gives us free will. And some entities have more free will than other because the monads, or the units that comprise those things, like us, have a greater balance of mental properties over physical properties.
What's funny about that, the question is that you were going to give opposite answers to what you would expect to this question. He believes in free will. As free will has been defined in the question, I do not. I believe that we have a will, we make choices, but I think our choices are based on our motives and desires and things of that sort. I do not believe in an indeterministic free will. And for the reason, one reason is because of the principle of sufficient reason, that you don't have an effect without a cause. It's a nonsensical comment to say that something comes into being by chance, for no reason, no explanation, no cause whatsoever. I do believe in a will. I believe in moral responsibility. I believe in making choices. I don't believe in indeterministic free will. And if you had, I don't see how talking about things happening by chance in quantum physics, if that's indeed what quantum physics proves, which I would disagree with, I don't see why things happening randomly have anything to do with people making choices, unless the point is that the choices are completely random, arbitrary events that have no connection with motives or goals or anything of the sort.
I don't believe that fossils are proof of a lack of a creator. I believe it's the preponderance of evidence taken in totality from the biological sciences, biology, ecology, as well as paleontology and other things, and the lack of transition, the lack of a record of transitional life forms is, in my mind, greater evidence for undiscovered finds in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which they have been discovering lately. Almost every 2 weeks in the New York Times, there's a new find of a fossil that is filling in the gaps. So I believe that using inferential reasoning, the fact that we have a bunch of dots, and the fact that there are some dots that are missing, doesn't mean that those dots will not be filled in and a line can be drawn forming a continuity of evolution. It just means that that those things haven't been discovered. I disagree with one of my students at Utah Valley State College that informed our class that fossils in the bottom of the Grand Canyon were put there by Satan to test our faith. I believe that that they were that they're remnants of life forms that existed millions of years ago, and that we have a record of them.
This will be an open question to either both of you to take. I'm going to just touch on something that David already brought before. It's a matter of deism as a solution to reconcile traditional philosophical limitations of an Abrahamic God, for example, free will versus determination. There's a number of how can you reconcile omniscience, omnipotence, and some of these things. But nonetheless, in order to address some of the valid reasons for a supernatural force, also to address things that may seem self-evident in the human experience, such as art, beauty, transcendence, poetry, idealism, in a sense, to reach for something larger than ourselves than secular humanism may seem to offer the human emotional experience.
People mean different things by it. Sometimes people use it as some kind of impersonal thing that started things off. Some people talk about it like it's a person of consciousness. And we talk about it's often described when they describe it, that a God who created the world, wound up, and then wandered off somewhere to do something. I don't know what that means exactly. I'm not really sure what the difference between deism and theism are. I do think there's a difference between deism and Christian theism. I think that if someone grants deism, if deism has any meaning, it means that there's a personal, that there's a being with consciousness who starts the world out for a purpose. So that's theism. So basically, you've already granted deism once you've gone that far, even if you haven't granted Christian theism. So I don't think it really reckons reconcile also the dispute between me and David. If you weren't to grant my side, probably to accept him to be Christian, but I didn't get to go into about the specifics of Christianity.
My point of bringing up deism was that it is a theism which is not anthropomorphic. It's not the Abrahamic personalistic God that Mark would like to get to. And so there are my point in bringing that up is that there are many different notions of God which do not lead to the desired conclusion of this afternoon, and that is the Abrahamic God. If God is deistic, then God has no foundation for ethics because God does not care about the human condition. Your point about beauty and poetry and all those things, the source of those, I believe, again, points to the failure of the mechanistic view of nature, that nature is a dead machine, and I believe that the natural world, nature as we know it, is a creative, energetic force, and that those properties that we call beauty and the leap to art and creativity and imagination are a fundamental part of nature and do not have a supernatural source, and that's where Mark and I differ on that.
All right, this question is for Mark. You used a few words that I'm very familiar with, but at the same time, in the sense you used them, there's some confusion there. I just wanted to see if I get some clarification. First of these are your use of purpose and suppose. In my experience, in my life, those words have meaning in relationships. You know, as a friend, as a brother, as a child, as a believer in God, there are things I'm supposed to do in aspects of these relationships. I have a purpose in these relationships. So the first of these, I want clarification, was what sense those words have if I were to live in isolation without a belief in God, there was a relationship. Because it seems your argument says because there is a God, there still is purpose, and there still is something I'm supposed to do. But if without those relationships myself, what sense does that have? And second, you want to describe God as being a personal being, and being outside of time and space. And again, in all my relationships, everything, all my experiences, personality, personhood, personness, every aspect of person, I understand those terms in relationship to time and space. I know David and Mark are distinct persons because by talking with them, I see a cohesion or a lack of cohesion between the two, and those develop my sense of person. So my second question is, what is personal? How is God a personal being? What do you mean when you say God is a personal being outside of time and space?
Right. The concept of supposed to-ness, as I call it, I think the idea of I'm supposed to do something implies that I was created to fulfill a purpose. Because it's supposed to have an ideal in mind, right? And I'm supposed to do this. There's some goal in mind that some ideal that I'm supposed to fulfill. Ideals are things that only persons have. So I agree with you. I think you're right. There has to be a relationship that I have, there has to be a person at the back of all things in order for there to be any kind of sense of supposedness that makes sense. If I exist by chance, then there's nothing I'm supposed to do. So we don't exist in isolation from God, and that's why we do have purpose in that sense. So I would kind of agree with you, maybe not that I think we were thinking, but in every respect. The second part was about the question of personal meaning. So personal meanings that you meet around you generally have bodies and live in time and space. And I have similar experience in life. But that doesn't mean that there can't be a person who's beyond those things. And I think there's a good reason to believe there must be based on those arguments for the existence of God. I mean, it doesn't make sense to say because something is outside of my experience, therefore I don't have any good reason it's incoherent. I don't think it is incoherent anymore. Saying, well, I don't think singularity is the beginning of my life, therefore the Big Bang didn't occur. And matter doesn't usually look like a singularity to me, so therefore everything can't have been unified in one singularity that everything came from. In both cases, there's supposedly good reasons for tracing these things that we do know back to these things that we don't know. And that's sort of the whole basis of both the argument for the Big Bang and the argument for the existence of God.
Quick, sharp questions.
This would be for David. Science tells us that the Earth has existed for 4.5 billion years approximately. So if a loving man or a loving woman could evolve from a fungi in 4.5 billion years, do you think it would be possible for a god to evolve from a man or a woman in 4.5 trillion years or more?
If what you mean by that kind of God is Nietzsche's Übermensch, absolutely yes.
Loving man and woman becomes a loving heavenly father or heavenly mother.
I don't have a problem with that.
The moment you mention Übermensch, that brings it into the humanistic realm. But if it's heavenly father, heavenly mother, then it means heaven. So therefore, that extra step to show that there's a heaven, that's what I'm saying, you know? And that's why I guess then we have some problem, and we haven't heard that from our
that sort of being, I assume that you mean wouldn't be a supernaturalistic being, but a naturalistic being.
Well,
both. I don't think that a supernatural being could evolve out of the natural world, because that would run contrary to everything that I've ever observed in my life. I don't know how you could get one category type out of a completely opposite category type.
That's clear with that. Okay.
There are Abrahamic traditions that are not anthropomorphic, where they do not project their God themselves in their own image, who in fact got procreated through a father and son, leaving the mother and daughter out. And in fact, that God, you know, they try to conceive of it, it's not only the universe, but the entire cosmos is its representation. And I find it kind of ironic that the atheists bear witness to Abraham, but not to his God. And they probably bear witness to Muhammad, Jesus, and Noah as well, but not to the God that they were bearing witness to. And the only other thing I wanted to mention is that evil can also be perceived not as a thing, but as a state. Finally, I wanted to just mention that science and religion actually are very important. Science is very important for the view among the three, how and what physical material. But above the trees, the view of the forest, that is really the job, the metaphysics is the job of religion. And they need to go to this thing.
Exactly. So I take that as a statement. So
yep.
David, could you please elaborate on bringing feminism into your argument for atheism? And Mark, could you please respond to David's elaboration? Thank you.
my point is that I believe that that feminism and other forms of postmodernism, I'll leave it at that, have brought to our attention in an appropriate and valuable way that there are human modalities of knowing which are not purely rational. That part of what it means to be a human being is to be rational, but that's not the whole picture. And that many philosophers who I adore, Kant and Descartes and Hume and others, probably overemphasized rationality at the expense of other human features. And I believe that one valuable lesson of feminism is that men, all human beings, men and women, are emotional beings. It's the non-rational component to the human psyche that religion has relevance to, not the logical part.
Okay, but Kant or Descartes, they are in the category of not Hume.
I should have left that Hume. My apologies.
I think that we people have emotions. Obviously, there's an emotional life to human beings, but I don't consider it relevant to. It's relevant, but it doesn't provide any sort of information. There's no, if something's not
respect to the cosmological idea, you're arguing for a first cause that is without a cause itself. How do you infer that the first cause must be conscious, especially with the possibility that consciousness itself may demand an explanation of the previous cause in history?
Well, I mean, basically, just to reiterate what I said in the opening statement, I think that the first cause must be conscious. One reason is because consciousness cannot be reduced to anything in non-consciousness, can't be reduced to non-mind. I think that we are consciousness needs an explanation, but the first cause, by definition, doesn't have any explanation because it is an explanation of the first cause. So I would just say that consciousness has to be traced back to the first cause.
Mark, that the first 15 minutes, you know, so that is a good job getting there. So that would definitely have to happen. You can take the time to react.
Mr. Mark, if you claim that religions are moral, how do you explain all the wars caused by religion? How do you explain the control of women by religion? And can you cite any specific incidents where atheists have caused wars or have defamed women?
Well, while Mark's collecting his thoughts, there have been some pretty abhorrent atheistic regimes in human history, national socialism. Yeah, but I'm just saying that there have been abhorrent atheistic regimes. Mussolini's fascism and Stalinism and Nazism. So.
What you meant perhaps was atheist humans. That's what you meant.
Yeah. There have been regimes that are not founded on religion, supernatural beliefs that have been evil. And Sam Harris made the argument, well, these weren't rational regimes, right? They were based on holding on reasoning. That's probably true. But I don't see that statement. There are a lot of people who, religion is a very broad topic. I don't believe in all religions. I believe in Christianity. Religions are just a bunch of worldviews that all seem to have one thing in common. They believe in supernatural things. So the fact that religions cause war is way too broad an issue to deal with. Maybe get down to Christianity in specific. It's really a very big question. I do think that people have done bad things in the name of Christianity, just like people have done bad things in the name of everything. I think that bad things do not have a basis for being done in Christianity, because I think that Christianity provides a foundation for morals. I do think that there can be a foundation for bad things being done in atheism, because atheism doesn't provide a foundation for morals. So I can say that while Christianity is inconsistent with any form of immorality, atheism is not. My statement there. As far as looking at specific examples, that would be the next step in this discussion. Which war, which event, how I respond to that would be the next step here.
This question is for Dr. Keller. Dr. Keller, are the rules of logic material or immaterial? And also, how would you define the constitution of the cosmos?
The rules of logic are a priori. In other words, they're conceptual. They're not. They're mathematical. A point has no dimensions. The width of a line has no width. They're mathematical conceptual constructions. With regard to your answer to the constitution of the cosmos, I've already defined that. I believe I will briefly reiterate. I reject the idea that there are two types of substances, material and immaterial, and that God, if one is not reducible to the other, and that God is the source of material substance. I believe that the fundamental units of matter consist of both types of properties. In philosophy, it's called monism, dipolar monism, and it's elaborated by philosophers such as Spinoza, Whitehead, and Leibniz.
I would like to address my remarks to David. The gentleman was quite sure. I want to be sure I have understood you correctly. You place a great deal of emphasis on logic. Is that correct? Yes or no?
Yes.
how does logic, and you say that in your observation, you have never observed anyone I want to be sure I quote you correctly. You have never observed anyone that has had an experience that could be in opposition to logic. Is that correct?
No, I didn't say that. Well, were you talking about the student? You said
there is overwhelming evidence. Now finish your sentence. Overwhelming evidence.
There's overwhelming evidence against the existence of a supernaturalistic being in a human form that is the creator, the sole foundation of reason of human existence, and who cares about humans.
You also said you have observed quite a number of your friends. Have you ever observed a woman who has been giving birth to four children, and how does logic explain that?
No, my sister has only told me about it, but I wasn't there. Logic doesn't explain birth, but the biological process of the replication of DNA and the gestation of the egg and mitosis and meiosis are all explainable in terms of empirical observation organized by conceptually consistent systems that are not incoherent and don't contradict themselves.
They're not explained by logic.
All right,
a mother doesn't give birth to her children as a result of
life.
Oh, no.
Then we go that direction. Okay. So that's pretty much the next question. Next question. My question is for Mark. You make a connection between this God and morality. You say that there is something outside of just human interaction that you have to do. You have a duty. Now, this causes you a problem because you then have to communicate with this being to find out what that is. How do you do that?
Good question. I think there are things that you can reason about, not only the existence, but also the nature of God from reason. One of those part of the argument that I was trying to try a little bit at the end of the 15 minutes. I had to rush through that a little bit, but you know, that a God who is omniscient will know the minds of all beings and therefore have a foundation for in itself the time and happiness of beings rather than the misery. I think you can do other things that I have time to show examples of how to reason other attributes. I think eventually, basically, I think you also bring in special revelation like the Bible to this. In other words, there's certain things we can know about God, about his nature, and about other aspects from reason. Christianity, for example, claims certain things about the universe, about the existence of God, about the nature of human beings, and I believe that those claims match up with reality to such a degree that it is rational to believe that the Bible is a revelation from God. So you start with reason. Reason takes you to eventually recognize that there's good reason to believe that the Bible is the Word of God. And thus then you have other information that you know on the basis of that revelation once you have good reason to think that it is the Word of God. So directly from reasoning and then indirectly from the special revelation that we have good reason to believe, from these sources we have the information we need to know about what God wants us to do.
Next question.
It seems to me that we're kind of in a debate of whether we go by science, which is facts and empirical evidence, or whether we go by faith, go by something that we can't prove, we're just sort of guessing them. And I follow Mark's argument about how we go cause and effect. That's all science. And suddenly you come to the end and you're going to drop science when you say consciousness. You drop it right there. And what I think is going to happen, I see where you're going at, but consciousness has got to be something, does it not? You say it's God. And I say consciousness is, we're going to discover what consciousness is when we discover molecular biology, when we discover how we evolve consciousness. And I'll tell you what I believe. I believe we have evolved consciousness. How have we evolved that? Well, take a chimpanzee. You know, some chimpanzees can recognize themselves in the mirror. That's a form of consciousness. That's the only other animal we know that recognizes themselves. Other animals that see something in the mirror think it's another horse, and they just shy away from it. But a chimpanzee will stop and he'll look. He realizes he plays himself. He realizes that it's himself that he's seeing in the mirror. What I'm saying is we have evolved consciousness. That's a human thing. That's evolution. That's science. We're going to understand consciousness when we understand molecular biology. We understand psychology. We understand the science of it. We'll figure it out. And it's not God.
I think there's a reason that you can't reduce mind to matter. So I've already given the argument for that basically, so I don't really have too much to add to it. And you can assert that you can evolve mind from matter, but you have to actually deal with the actual argument instead of simply asserting.
This question is for both speakers. Within your worldview, how do you account for and why do you trust universal abstract philosophical concepts such as the laws of formal logic? Why are these good tools for answering questions? And then, that was kind of already answered by Dr. Keller. But as a further question, at what point in your opponent's arguments did they step into the irrational?
So what was the first part of that? Why do you believe in laws of logic?
Yeah. Yeah. How can you account for them within your worldview, and why do you trust them?
The laws of logic, I think, are observable aspects of the nature of existence. Logic is an observable aspect of existence. To even talk about being is to have logic involved already. Because logic is basically a thing that if you have, if something is true, it obviously can't be true. That's basically logic. And if you have being and you don't have non-being, if something that exists, you don't have nothing that exists. So the very concept of being involves the existence of logic. So the fact that we know that something exists, I think itself is direct, self-evident, observational proof of the existence of logic. So that's the first question. And the second one was, at what point did I see rationality arising in David's argument? I think that he did not successfully respond to the arguments for the existence of God. I think he ended up really relying on assertions against those arguments. And quoting science, and science really did not answer the objections about the need for a first cause or the need for consciousness to be separate from matter. So I would say the irrationality was in not actually answering the arguments, simply asserting that they were false without really giving any real substantial proof of that, and arguing other things that really, like the basis of science, that really didn't prove his position that you can explain the universe without a personal first cause. And then I have some other particular areas as well, but those are some major ones.
Briefly, the laws of logic hold because the physical properties of the fundamental units of nature are describable by the mechanistic mathematical property of physicality. And that's where the laws of logic hold, and that's where they fail to hold when it comes to creativity and things related to the mental properties of nature. Marx's argument flirted with irrationalism at the point which this gentleman described in using a causal chain that was observable within the categories of our everyday experience, and then suddenly jumping off the end of the diving board and entering a realm, a supernatural realm, beyond our pale of experience. So it's an invalid inference to go from the knowable to the unknowable. I believe that I did address the intrinsic logical fallacy of the first cause argument by bringing that philosophical principle to the fore. You cannot infer supernaturalism from naturalism. It's a category error.
Last question.
This is for Mark. In the New Testament, there was one chapter where Christ had just been hung on a cross, and he says, God, forgive these people, they don't know what they're doing. Okay. Now we have another chapter, and again, Christ is hung on a cross, he says, Eli, Eli. Well, Eli, Eli means Hebrew for God. God, why hast thou forsaken me? Now, how do you correlate these two chapters? One, he says, God, why have you forsaken me? In another chapter, he says, forgive these people, they don't know what you're doing.
I don't know why they're contradictory. I'm not sure I understand the basis of finding a problem between them. The one passage, obviously the passages in general assume a Trinitarian understanding of God, but I don't have time to defend right now. But the one is saying is when the Son of God is taking upon himself the wrath of God against sin and expressing the alienation from the Father due to sin. The other passage is Christ expressing a desire for forgiveness of his persecutors. So I don't understand why you see those as being contradictory.
I don't think we can find it.
Right, so let's leave it at that and we can pursue that afterwards. Okay, I think it's the last question, but two of you have shown up here. So how about very quickly,
okay.
Your question.
All right, if this discussion could go on tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, for the next year, which of you two would concede first?
Which one?
Concede from second of argument for a year.
Mark would. I've got reason and rationality on my side.
I have reason and rationality on my side, so it would be David. Well, actually, I don't know if David would be. Hopefully, he would eventually. We will pray for him.
Thank you for the opportunity to ask this question. It truly is a question. It just has two parts to it. I would like both speakers, if you choose to answer this. The first part to the question is, if there is no God, let's say for a moment there is no God. Okay. Imagine that. If there is no God, is there a problem with constructing a worldview based on the existence of a God? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If there is no God, is there a problem constructing a worldview based on the existence of a God? The second part to this is, let's say there is a God. For a moment, there is a God, whether we recognize it or not. Is there a problem with living a moral life for one individual that doesn't have the belief of that God in existence? So, thanks.
Those are two good questions. Briefly, I believe that in and of itself, it's not intrinsically problematic to construct a social system of religion when there is, in fact, no God. In fact, I believe that's the case. What is important for human beings to coexist is simply to adopt a similar set of rules for practical reasons. And so it's the similarity of life rituals in a community that is more important than what the content of those rituals are. And I believe that explains the diversity of religions around the world and the reason that many of these religions, the non-theistic ones that Dean referred to, Buddhism and Confucianism, and the theistic ones of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have persisted for so long is that they give a continuity to communities and human life. The fact that there is no transcendent source of those rules doesn't seem to matter in our everyday lives. I believe that secular humanism can also provide those rules. As Dean alluded to, many of the moral theories that appeal to me from the ancient Greeks through Kant and Mill and the Enlightenment philosophers are secular moral systems devoid of supernaturalism.
So if we assume for a minute that atheism is true, then would it be a problem if people construct a belief in God? I think that even from an atheistic perspective, any construction of a false belief would be a dangerous thing. Actually, it's kind of sympathetic to Harris and Dawkins and some of those guys who think that any false belief is going to be intrinsically dangerous because it causes you to believe in a false world, and therefore causes you to act in ways that are inadequate to reality. So I think it's very dangerous to construct any false view. So if I believe religion was an extremely dangerous thing. On the other hand, if I was an atheist also, I would also say, well, to maybe a particular person might have a form of religion that in itself, in that person, in their own lifetime, might not be dangerous to me or those things that I care about. And therefore, why not let them carry on their delusion until they die and go out of existence anyway? So it really doesn't make too much difference, probably. So a couple of different sides of that. If theism is true, and particularly, let's make it more specific, Christian theism is true, then it is extremely problematic to form a belief apart without God, because one of the things that God demands, in fact, the prime thing that God desires in life, is that people glorify Him and honor Him as God. And therefore, to construct a worldview without God, from a Christian perspective, is to miss the entire point of existence and to be in opposition to the entire point of existence.
I have to ask, which is that it's not the point as to who can see first. The whole idea of this enterprise is to engage in a civil dialogue of fundamental importance, and then we look at our own position, other's position, share ideas with mutuality and respect. That's the essence of great American political democratic pluralism. That's the great essence and the idea of capitalism in America, and in that spirit, this is great force I conducted, and hopefully the ideas will go on, we'll get a bit more about it.
So, like, thank you.
Shelf and records I got from different